When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I've become a director of Chelsea Football Club.
Chelsea have won the Champions League!
We went to Champions League games. You meet with the directors of the other club for dinner the night before. I won't pretend that it's not also satisfying to kind of be on the team playing. We don't want to let the fans down. Getting to know Frank Lampard, somebody that I thought I'd never even meet. One of the stipulations in my contract as a director of Chelsea Holdings. My mother was arrested at the age of 10. My father was arrested at the age of 10. The gulag is a phrase, but I didn't know what it was either, even though I knew my grandfather had been in it. There are a number of reasons why the Nazi story is a lot better known. One of the reasons being that they obviously lost and the Soviets won. That protected the Soviets from scrutiny, and everything that happened in the Nuremberg trials, the Soviets were the prosecutors, and all of those crimes that the Nazis committed, they committed too. The main thing that I do really is working for the Times newspaper. When you get an invitation, imagine this invitation was tomorrow. If it was tomorrow, would you feel it was a good use of your time, and would you want to say yes to it?
So what's the job of Danny Finkelstein?
Well, I've got more than one job, I suppose. I regard my mainstay, the main thing that I do really, is working for the Times newspaper, where I've previously been an executive editor, and I have been a columnist for a long time, and I still centre myself there a lot of the time, regard that as my sort of primary role. But when I got a peerage 10 years ago, I went off the staff, and since then I've taken on a couple of other things. So I'm director of a company called Upmost, which is a financial services company dealing primarily with I won't complicate everyone with all the details, but sort of a funds in runoff for those people who have a knowledge of these kind of areas. And more recently, I've become a director of Chelsea Football Club, which is actually, although I'm a non-executive director, takes up a lot of time because it's got quite a lot of executive functions linked to it.
And talk to us about the different jobs at the Times, in terms of, it's always intrigued me, all the different roles that are there, because you've got comment editors, feature editors, an executive editor, as you just mentioned. How's it all sort of structured? What are the different roles you've done? Yeah, which ones did you enjoy most, etc.?
The way to think of it really is that newspapers don't only sell content, they sell editing. When you read a newspaper, you are reading a choice that's been made for you of all the things that have happened in that day that people might be interested in or been happening in that week, curated, checked for accuracy, provided with a headline that gives, you know, that intrigues, but also gives a summary of some of the content. That work, I think that is one of the primary things that we sell. In other words, on the internet, for example, there's plenty of information you can get, but you can only get editing from a newspaper or from a curated product. So a very important part of what we do is editing. And so there are two different types of jobs at the Times, one of which is that job of editing, the curation, and the other is the job of provision of the material itself. And I guess you could see the staff has been kind of divided between those. I had a somewhat odd career, which is that I made tracks down both of those routes at the same time. So I guess a usual thing will be for someone after a while to specialise in becoming an editor or a content provider. Almost everyone starts as some sort of content provider, some sort of journalist, but then they will get into more and more editing, and the most senior people in the paper, the editor, the executive editor, the deputy editor, those people, or the, you know, the comment page editor, those people will all have jobs that are purely editing. They don't write anything. And I was somewhat odd. So I was the comment editor while I had my own column. I was the executive editor and still wrote for the paper. So it was unusual. And then when the peerage arrived and I wanted to accept it, it was agreed that I should carry on my writing work but stop the editing, because it became less appropriate for me to edit to sort of curate other people's content. So the jobs I've had in the paper, I've had the job, the senior ones worth mentioning, after I'd been a lead writer when I arrived at the paper and contributed to features and various other things, I became eventually the comment editor on the paper. That is the person who was editing all the opinion columns. You give a bit of guidance to the editor as to who you think we should have writing columns, but an awful lot of that job is just making sure the columnists don't write on the same topic, that they're not going to get the paper sued, you know, in other words, that it's been appropriately passed to the lawyer, you've given it the right headline, you have a right variety, you don't have big areas where nobody's written on a column on it for several days, even though it's the biggest story of the moment, all those kind of things. And I did that for a while, and then I was asked to be the chief leader writer because James Harding, when he became editor of the paper, wanted to move the leaders to page two. He was going to put much more resources into writing the leaders because he thought, and I think correctly, more people would then read them. And I was put in charge of that. And that was a combination of writing leaders and also kind of leading the team. And maybe of all the jobs I've had, that may have been the most fun. The job there was to create an identity for the paper that was in line with the editor's wishes, to think about where you were going to go, probably between elections, and try to work out how to take the steps towards it so that you weren't writing things 1 year that were completely inconsistent the next, to have an idea of where you stood on where the paper stood on all the issues, that the big issues, and so you weren't contradicting yourself. You know, we did do that in one or two. If someone goes on holiday, a newspaper can contradict itself, and we did. You know, our sister dying, we contradicted ourselves. And I know before I arrived, the paper contradicted itself on drug use as well. And you know, you want to avoid doing that. That's what the chief leader writer is for. And then the paper went behind a paywall, and I was asked to be the executive editor in charge of that. So before I worked in politics, which was the job I had immediately before I went into the newspaper, I'd actually previously been a journalist on trade newspapers. And my big area was the internet. I've got an MSc in systems analysis. And it was partly my father had been involved in some of the earliest computers. And he said to me, you know, computing and system analysis and digitalization is where everything's going. Getting ahead of it. And I did. And it was very useful at this point, because when we went behind the paywall, you didn't really need to have a total understanding of the technology, but it helped a lot when you were dealing with, you know, the sort of art staff and other people who were working on the design and working on the systems upgrade to allow you to do things you wanted to do. So I did that for a period. And then I stopped doing that at the time when I was offered the peerage, which also coincided actually with James Harding leaving the paper. So for John Witherow, who became the editor then, I worked as an associate editor, which I joke, always a joke, means I was associate of nobody and edited nothing.
And how does a newspaper kind of set its culture? Because it must be, you know, it's obviously a demanding place to work, so you've got a daily product that you need to get out. But how do you sort of step out of that? How do newspapers do that?
Well, I mean, any newspaper, any organisation, the culture is very much set at the top. And I've been fortunate to work in environments where kind of shouting and boorish behaviour isn't tolerated. The Times has been a very civilized place. It's dynamic enough, so it doesn't pretend to itself it's a university or a seminar. It's dynamic enough, but relationships are pretty friendly, and the editor sets the culture. It is quite a pressured environment, and I one of my roles when I was executive editor, in fact before that when I was chief lead writer, was to edit the paper on a weekend, and on a Sunday, and you know, it's an extraordinary responsibility because you've got to pick what's on the front page and all those sort of things. The editor. The actual editor, as it were, is there to consult, but still you have to make these big choices. And I experienced how incredibly pressured it can be in those environments. But I think, you know, people have just got to control their stress when they're in those environments, and I usually manage it.
Yeah, completely. And that's one of I wanted to talk about your book that you published this year, Hitler, Stalin, and My Family, which is just the most kind of extraordinary reading that I've done this year. And one of the things that I was struck by during it was how hard it was to kind of listen to it. I was listening to it on audiobooks, and I couldn't listen to more than about half an hour because at times it's such a difficult listen. I just wondered, with you and your personality, which you describe as Pollyanna-ish in one of your books, how do you keep such a positive mindset when you're writing something like that? Or is that even possible?
Yeah, so first of all, you're right to remind me that while I've given you the jobs that I'm employed by someone else to do, I didn't mention actually something that's been really a very large use of my time over the last 3 or 4 years, which is the writing and then the promotion of the book. And by the way, anyone who's doing a book should know that, you know, writing and editing and everything, the book is one thing, but promoting it, that's quite something else. It's been really exhausting. I mean, it's been very satisfying, but it's been very exhausting. So it's interesting. I think my attitude to life is definitely partly DNA. Okay. It's just who I am. And I think it was true because one of the things I puzzle over in the book is how did my parents end up being such positive people, considering what happened to either of them, considering, you know, the Holocaust to my mom and what happened, my dad's experience in with the Soviets. So and I think it was partly their character, as simple as that. But it was also a deliberate view that they had that a sense of proportion is really important, and that nothing else that could happen to them would ever be as bad as that, or to us. And the only time in my childhood I ever remember getting into trouble, and it wasn't that bad even then, but trouble, was when I said before dinner once that I was starving. Mm. And my mother was really cross about it. I just remember being startled because it was obviously just a casual statement. And she was generally so gentle. But I think that that offended her sense of proportion. And generally, I see people a lot of time both arguing with each other and behaving in ways towards each other, which startle me as well. You know, startle me like Mum's thing did. I just can't understand it really, and I think that comes from my parents. It seems to me that below the level of the events that happen to them, it should be possible for us to have the most incredibly civilized discourse.
And how long did it take to write the book? Or is it impossible to put a time on it because it's just something that's been in the works for such a long time, your entire life?
Well, look, I wonder very openly whether this book would have happened if my normal schedule had gone ahead. And one of the things that I have been thinking about ever since is, you know, was I utilizing my time correctly? So there are a number of things that I think are difficult when you are when you have a portfolio life. One of them is not to organize yourself so that you spend an awful lot of your working day simply traveling between your jobs, not adding value to anybody because all you're doing is traveling. Another is accepting a lot of meetings just because you don't do one thing. You can accept a lot of meetings, much of which don't add value either. And what happened with COVID is that both those two things stopped, and I was amazed by how much time that left me. I worked very hard during COVID, but most importantly, I worked incredibly productively because suddenly I wasn't traveling, I'm based in three places, in Stamford Bridge, London Bridge and Westminster Bridge. If I'm not careful, you know, I try and organise my life so that I concentrate my Chelsea meetings, for example, on one day a week. I mean, there are other days when I have to do stuff, but I try and concentrate it. Otherwise, I just end up travelling all the time. So with this, I spent, it was probably 4 years since between the time when I first thought, right, I'm definitely going to do this book, and I agreed that with my agent, and the time when the book appeared in a bookshop. There was obviously the preparing a proposal, but there was also doing a lot of reading so that I actually understood the history of the Second World War properly. My mother had been in Belsen, but did I really understand what that was? Well, not really, no, not until I read about it. The Gulag is a phrase, but I didn't know what it was either, even though I knew my grandfather had been in it. So even for someone who had a kind of history and knew the background a bit, I was amazed by what I didn't know. So while I was doing lots of other things, I began to do reading of that kind. What you know, reading a book on the Wannsee Conference, where the final solution was agreed, reading a book about I spent a month reading books about Lvov, which is where my father was brought up, even though I only have about three paragraphs probably of that research in the piece itself. So that was the background, and then I wrote a proposal, and then COVID happened. And when COVID happened, it enabled me to stay at home. And in all the time that I was otherwise wasting travelling around or meeting PhD students who wanted to interview people who had lost elections and thought I was a good person to interview, that I decided that you know, so I didn't do that. And I was able then to sit down where I am now and go through an amazingly large number of family documents that have been left me. And I went through them one by one by one, with every line very carefully, and then I set myself a task: 1,000 words a day, 4 days a week. The reason for 4 days a week is I wanted to leave the day that I wrote my column, which is actually now also the day that we record the How to Win Election, my podcast. I wanted to leave the basically Tuesdays where I didn't have to write 1,000 words on anything else, and then the other days of the week I'd write 1,000 words, and that worked well.
And how? I'm just so intrigued about how you kind of pull all these things together. I mean, if you were giving advice to someone who's thinking of writing a memoir, even if it's not for publication, like, how do you go about sort of structuring something like that? What advice would you give to someone?
Sure. Well, so it helped me. Doing the structure of the story was the first thing that I did. So I knew going into it, I had a particular structural problem. My mother was arrested at the age of 10 on the 20th of June, 1943. My father was arrested at the age of 10, but that meant he was arrested in April the 14th, 1940. By the time my mother was arrested, my father had been taken to the State Collective Farm, then gone to Semipalatinsk, where they nearly froze there as well, joined the Anders Army, crossed the Caspian Sea, gone to Iran, and eventually to Palestine. So all of that had happened before my mother was even arrested. And I worried about how to structure it. But of course, there were lots of things that happened to my mother while my father was going through that, because the Nazis had invaded and all that. So I sat down and spent a lot of time working about how I would pace the book through the various stories, and also how I would, you know, one of the things that I did in my very first draft was that I was giving away the end of various family stories, just at the big, you know, casually. And one of the things that I've learned in journalism as well, don't you hold back your material. The material is gold. You have to spread it out. You have to. And I watched something called Masterclass with Aaron Sorkin. And he was just talking about story. And it was nothing specific that he told me, but just that immersing myself in the idea of how to tell stories made me think, well, hang on a minute, I'm not actually pacing this story correctly. So I spent I didn't write anything until I'd really got the structure of the whole story. And I know I think that's also true of Robert Harris, you know, who's a friend of mine who does, you know, who's a brilliantly successful novelist. He also does that. Some people just write and let, you know, the characters or whatever go, I could not have done that. And I don't think this book would have worked like that. I had to work very hard on the structure.
And how many hours do you think you've spent on publicity? Because that is interesting. It's similar with a podcast, right? Like, it's recording the content is one thing, and then actually sort of the time spent on distribution is extraordinary, is one of my reflections of doing this for 3 years. But how much time do you think you've spent on book publicity?
Well, difficult. There was a period where I, because of the book, but also because of Chelsea, to be fair, I found myself and some residual. Because the times that it really happens in the evening. So I sometimes things as well. I found myself literally out every single night. So I was leaving the house here, usually take my son to the station at kind of 7:20 or 7:30. And I didn't come back till 11 almost every day, day after day after day. And then often on the weekend, there'd be a football match, which I love to go to. But obviously I've got also job, you know, also tasks related to that, so it can be tiring even though it's amazing and a real privilege, that became a bit much. So I for the first time I here's my dilemma that I've had for ages, and it's been coming up upon me for a long time, which is that I don't really want to say no to people who would like me to come and talk or appear on their podcasts or you know, particularly people I like or admire, and there are lots of people like that, but I've reached a point I suddenly realized where I simply actually physically can't, and I was still doing that, so I had this brilliant bit of advice which was given to me by Howell James, who was John Major's private secretary. Also, he's got his own agency. He worked also for big banks, and he worked for Capital Radio, Verisign. He's an amazing guy. And I was complaining to him that I was quite busy, and he said, only when you get an invitation, imagine this invitation was tomorrow. If it was tomorrow, would you feel it was a good use of your time, and would you want to say yes to it? I found that really, really useful. I've ignored it too much. Now I've finally realised I just have to do that. So I've begun to turn down more things.
Yeah. It's difficult to have to say no, though, right? What was the most surprising thing that you learnt about the Second World War in the research for the book? Because we all think we know a lot about it, you know, studying it in school, et cetera, et cetera. But what was the thing that surprised you most?
Well, first of all, I didn't understand what Belsen was. So understanding that Belsen was an exchange camp rather than an extermination camp, that was really, really, improved my insight into what my mother's experience had been, and to why that camp collapsed in the way that it did, and why it's a symbol in the way that it is. I had not understood that. Then the other thing that I learned, which I didn't really know, I didn't understand about Soviet collective farms and who worked on them and people's experience. And, you know, lots of people don't know, and I was among them. Hundreds of thousands of Poles were deported to do this work in an attempt to destroy the Polish leadership. I think people who read my book will think to themselves that my mother's story is an extraordinary version of the Holocaust story, but they know about the Holocaust. They will then find my father's story, which frankly is just a standard version, though he did survive it, obviously, of something that happened to hundreds of thousands of people that people just don't know anything about.
I guess tell us a bit about, for those that haven't read the book, that story about the sort of eastern side of the war that doesn't get reported on. Because you talk about it in the conclusion, and it's very powerful, as you were saying.
Absolutely. So the Nazi, there are a number of reasons why the Nazi story is a lot better known. One of the reasons being that they obviously lost and the Soviets won. That protected the Soviets from scrutiny, and everything that happened in the Nuremberg trials. My grandfather was very much involved in the Nuremberg trials, providing evidence on the Nazis, but the Soviets were the prosecutors, and all of those crimes that the Nazis committed, they committed too. I think that was, you know, that was kind of very interesting to find out. The way I've put it is that the Nazis arrested all the Jews, some of whom were shopkeepers, and the Soviets arrested all the shopkeepers, some of whom were Jews. And my father was the subject of this latter expulsion. They had two, I think, reasons for doing it. The first was it was a way of suppressing dissent. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact meant they took over Eastern Poland, the Soviets, and they had rigged elections, effectively. I mean, you can see this pattern now. They had rigged elections, integrated the Soviet, the Lvov into become Soviet Ukraine from being Eastern Poland, and they could then do what they liked with the population. And in fact, the man who was in charge of that came and lived opposite my dad. You could, out of my dad's bedroom window, you could see his house, and that was Khrushchev. He was obviously known for his leadership later. So one aim was to suppress the dissent. So they obviously, my grandfather, being a very wealthy man, a city councillor, he could be a subject of dissent. But also the families, they deported the families hundreds and or thousands of miles to these state collective farms. And many of them died along the way or would die eventually. But here's the other reason they did that. It was a sort of, I jokingly call it, a kind of Soviet form of levelling up, right? They wanted to populate the interior with people. Mm. So while they were waiting for these people, these potential dissidents to die, and they didn't care if they did, they'd be quite useful farmers. And in fact, later, when the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact falls apart because Hitler invades the Soviet Union, my grandmother, in fact, both my grandparents are then told, my grandfather, mother and my grandfather on my father's side, are both told by their people who imprisoned them, you should stay here as a free citizen because you can help us farm. You know, don't go anywhere else. There's no food there, which was also true. It was, of all the things that my grandmother decides to do, I think one of the most courageous is deciding to leave this state collective farm in the middle of nowhere, to go to Semipalatinsk itself, you know, 3 days by horse and cart, where she has no money and no accommodation. She ends up sleeping on the street with my dad. That was incredibly courageous of them.
Yeah, completely. No, it's it really is an amazing book, and for someone who studied that period a lot, there was a lot that I learned from it, and it was it was pretty incredible to kind of think about being faced with some of those decisions and the decisions they took. One of the things that I wanted to talk about as well, which I think will be of a lot of interest to people, is the job that you mentioned earlier of being a non-exec director at Chelsea, and just what that kind of involves and what kind of your responsibilities are. I mean, you touched on match day there. I mean, that might be quite an interesting place to start on it, about what are the responsibilities.
Well, this came about because I'd worked with Jonathan Goldstein, who's Todd Bowley's business partner, and Todd and he felt that they were trying to take over the club. They had a lot of good plans for it, but they wanted to be sure they did it with rather than against the fans. Therefore it was important to them to have people on the board who supported Chelsea. And I had done since I was 6 or 7. So this amazing opportunity came to me. I guess I've got 3 or 4 things that I do. One is the kind of normal job of a non-executive director, ensuring that, robust safeguarding procedures and that we're financially solvent and those kind of things. Obviously into that falls also our sporting success. I'm not the owner and I'm not a sporting director. They're the people that deal mainly with those kind of decisions, but obviously I'm a part of it to some extent. Then the second thing I've done is taken over Chelsea's charitable foundation. We'll say taken it over. I've become the chairman of that. We've got lots of great plans for that, and I'm really excited by it. Chelsea have done lots of great work in that space, from combating racism through to incredible social work, helping young people and using the power of football to do that. Then the other role I've got is that I'm something called the nominated board level executive, board level officer, an NBLO. It's everything has to have an acronym for fan engagement. One of the things that we promised during the bid process was that we would be pioneers in terms of fan consultation. The Premier League's got a framework asking each club to provide somebody who has the responsibility for that, and that is me. But one of my responsibilities, which is kind of amusing in a funny way, it's amusing if you're a Chelsea fan. One of the stipulations in my contract as a director of Chelsea Holdings PLC is that I, not PLC, Limited, that I ensure that I'm present at sufficient number of matches, which is not an onerous condition of any contract. My opinion is that when a club visits Chelsea or when Chelsea visits another club, we ought to make the best possible impression we can, be as friendly and as engaging as we can, and that requires you put an effort in. I think that's important for the kind of instrumental reason, you know, that we want to have good relations with people we may trade with and with whom we share lots of interests, within the Premier League or if it's a cup game within the league in general. Good relations with those people are important, but it's also important on a human basis. Certainly it is to me. I want them to go away feeling, which club we really liked visiting, that was really nice when they visited, was Chelsea. You know, I think that's important.
When was the first time you visited Stamford Bridge?
So I must have been seven. So it's interesting. It leaks. The reason why I say it must have been, so I was taken... I was kind of so young. I've actually got a bit of a hazy view about which exact game was my first game, which is slightly embarrassing. Everyone always knows what their first game was. I remember watching Chelsea play Liverpool at home, and it must have been 1971 or so. I kind of think maybe there was one game before that. But anyway, I was 7 years old when I became a Chelsea fan. My dad had no interest in football at all. And again, that was a little bit his DNA. His interests were, you know, the progressive rabbis of Warsaw of the 19th century. I mean, genuinely, that was what he was interested in. He wasn't interested in football at all. He very kindly took me to some Hendon games, but he didn't have any interest in it. And I became a football fan because my friend Martin Levine, his parents had a shop in Chelsea. And so they took me to my first game, I just remember loving it always and thinking to myself, having a season ticket, would be the most glorious thing that you could imagine. Obviously, it was beyond my imagination, and indeed remained beyond my imagination until about 10 minutes before it happened, that I'd ever be a director of the club.
And what was the best part of the job?
Look, I get a lot of satisfaction over anything that we can do to improve Chelsea, and working on the foundation is one of those things, just alongside all these incredible people that are doing such great work. But also, the engagement with the fan groups, from whom I'm constantly learning a lot, but hopefully they feel, you know, we had a fan advisory board only the other day, and I remember thinking, God, this is actually a big step forward in the management of a club. It's really helpful. The exchanges between the executives, who were very impressive, and the fan board, who were also impressive, was really exciting. And as you know, Jimmy, I think one of the things that I learned, but you probably already know from the fan panel of Tracy Crouch's review, I was just blown away by how every club has got really incredibly impressive fans with such knowledge and insights to offer. And we're learning all the time. So that is very satisfying. But, you know, I won't pretend that it's not also satisfying to kind of be on the team plane, and you know, which I am occasionally. And you know, I remember, well, when you know, we went when we played Real Madrid and just going to Bernabeu. It's just been very, all those kind of things that a fan would be excited by. I don't pretend that I'm not excited by them. I am.
And has it dulled the, when somebody takes their passion and turns it into a sort of professional capacity, one of the things I've learned on this podcast is it can sort of dull that passion for it. Has that happened at all?
No. No, it hasn't at all. My wife said, I can't believe the way you monetize your hobbies. Because obviously, you know, my great passions in life, politics, apart from my family, right? You know, yeah. Which is just amazing and important to my life, and I've always been so lucky with it. But even then, I've written a book about my family. You know, if you think about it, it's my family, newspaper journalism, and in particular the Times from a very young age, Chelsea Football Club, and I've managed to kind of make professional, be involved in a professional capacity in all those things, and politics. And the only one that's missing there is the Beatles. I haven't managed to monetize that. I've written some articles about them, but hasn't quite happened. I did interview George Martin once, so I suppose I touched on even that. But it hasn't dulled it at all. With Chelsea, I think I was thinking this the other day, because as you're possibly aware, you know, the last 2 weeks or 3 weeks and everything in particular, we haven't had the best results. And I've been really disappointed, and it's made me feel really, you know, you can feel it inside when you don't do well. But I've always felt like that. I do feel an additional sense of responsibility. You know, the one thing that I think everyone in the ownership and directors team is, we don't want to let the fans down. We're doing what we think are the best things. And when what you think is the right thing to do doesn't work, you feel bad about it. Obviously you do. It probably has added a sort of degree of tension to it, which is greater. But like any fan, I always hated it if we lost.
Yeah. What surprised you most about it all?
Well, that's interesting. So sometimes I've learned from the sporting directors that I'm watching too much. So this is the thing about watching. I've learned I'm watching from on the ball. Secondly, something that of course should have occurred to me and didn't. Lots of people who work for a football club don't support that club. Right, because they've got jobs in the football industry, and they've got this one at the moment, and they obviously want the club to be successful because they're involved in it in every way, but they don't support it on the football side, which I find really odd. I mean, I find it quite difficult, I think, but they obviously don't, and you know, overcome it in really a very professional way. But it's an industry. Another thing that had not properly occurred to me, so everyone talks about how football's a business, and you know, when it shouldn't be, that's, you know, the kind of fan view. And then the other thing that people think is football is, you know, football's like a religion, which it also is, right? But what I think people, what I didn't expect was how much it is like a club. So the thing that I didn't, for example, know, when we went to Champions League games, and I think it's true in all the European competitions, you meet with the directors of the other club for dinner the night before, and then everyone exchanges little gifts, and there are friendly speeches that, you know, toasts are proposed and all that sort of stuff. And that had never occurred to me. And of course it happens. There's an awful lot of, an element of club in you know, with a sort of capital C about it, which I, you know, as I said, I understood that both the business bit and the incredible emotional attachment, that it's much more, you know, Bill Shankly was right about that, you know.
Yeah.
It's more important than that.
What other things might surprise people? I mean, that is, I didn't know that. Well, funnily enough, Derby County haven't had that many European away trips, but what other things happen that people might not appreciate?
I think a lot of times when you read, I've learned to sort of follow the business of the club in a more rigorous way. So, for example, when you read about transfers, all the transfers are about the fee. And a crucial point that's always missing is it's the wages. That the finance of the club is relates to the wages, not just how much you pay for players. And I hadn't completely appreciated that from outside as much as I should have done. I think that the other thing is, you know, all of us who are watching the game, from the manager right through to the directors, you can't, you know, I'm as much at mercy of Everton scoring against Chelsea as any fan in the stadium, right? You don't have any more control of it than anybody else. And I think that's, you know, kind of when you're just watching it, you sort of think, well, surely somebody ought to go and do something about this. And, you know, people are trying to do something about it, but it doesn't mean you necessarily score.
Yeah, that's fair. What are the kind of similarities that you've spotted between football and politics now working in both of them?
So the big thing about it is, I think, there's in all... So there are a number of things that you spot in politics. People are very loss-averse. In other words, when you change anything... people feel the change very keenly, more keenly than perhaps the benefit from the change. And I that's very true in politics. It's really important. And it's the reason why it's so hard in low growth environments for political parties, because when they move money to a new group of people, they have to move it from someone, and the person they move it from is usually more annoyed than the person they move it to is pleased. And I think that's also true in clubs. The other thing I've learned is the importance of something that's all very important in politics too, the insider-outsider problem. Okay, so you have a limited number of seats in a game, and we've got many, many more fans. I mean, you know, multiples of hundreds of thousands more fans than we can fit in the stadium. You obviously want to satisfy the fans that are in the stadium, but you want new people to come and see Chelsea. An absolutely classic example of the insider-outsider problem is the fact that Chelsea's game has been moved to Christmas Eve. Not actually, by the way, the choice of Chelsea. It's just the way that it happened. This happened because the TV thought this was an attractive game, and we're flattered and pleased to be on the television and have our game on television. Obviously, having our game on television means hundreds, of, you know, millions of people who wouldn't be able to see the game are now able to see it, or they're able to see it more easily, because some people obviously do find ways of watching games that are at 3 o'clock on a Saturday when there's a TV blackout. But this game's now been moved to a Sunday. However, there are also 3,000 people who are going to go to this game. And by the way, it's no point in thinking, well, they could just not go, because for lots of fans... it's a kind of commitment, right? They go to the away game, and we're so incredibly beholden and pleased that people go to our give our team support away from home. It's incredibly important to the result and to the vibe of the club. So they're very important people to us, the away travelling fans. But at the same time, you have these two completely different reactions. One were the people who could imagine themselves travelling, and Christmas Eve is a pain, and they had to then explain to their partners that what they weren't going to be there. But then the other people were reacting, well, it's great. So you have that problem the whole time, and it's the same thing with work on the railways, right, where the union pushes up this the money, and it has an impact on everyone who pays to go to work on the railways, and also in terms of how many jobs there are on the railways as well. So it's an insider-outsider problem there.
That's great. Just a couple more to finish with. What advice would you give to somebody wanting to kind of get into journalism, wanting to get a job at the Times? What changes have you noticed in the industry over the decades? What would be your advice to someone?
Two pieces of advice, one of which is an eternal one, and the other of which is kind of relatively new. So the eternal one is people think that the ability to write is what newspapers are looking for. And it's important to be able to write clean prose. And but we do edit the paper, and not every journalist we have is equally good at expressing themselves. What you have to be in order to work at the Times is both knowledgeable and able to find out knowledge in areas that you don't know about. So we are supplying to our readers knowledge of what happens, and we look for sufficient expertise. Sure, some people in the paper work in areas where they previously didn't know anything and they become then experts. But it's, I think you are, even if it's, you know, like one of my brilliant colleagues, Hilary Rose, who writes, I think, really, really clever, funny pieces. What she brings is, you know, kind of an attitude, a way of looking at the world, which is unique. Think, what can you bring to the to people that they don't know first, as opposed to simply how do I express myself?
Yeah,
that would be my first thing. And then the piece of advice that's more current is I do think being able to make video and social media content is going to become more and more important for journalists, and knowing how to develop that. You know, I've tried to stay on top of that as well as I can, although I'm very strong on Twitter, but I'm much weaker on TikTok or Instagram.
Yeah.
And they are always of projecting your copy and getting people to read the paper.
Yeah, it's probably going to become more important in football jobs as well. I always think it's partly turning into media companies in their own right as well. There's one lovely line in the book, which I think kind of relates to that knowledge bit, which is a letter in the exchange chapter, and it's from Greta, and it says, "The greatest happiness in life is for every thinking person is the development of their personality." I just thought that sort of encapsulated such a lovely kind of phrase of one's development of life and how to sort of think. Like, how do you think about that kind of development of personality yourself? I mean, you've taken on so many different jobs which kind of make up such a big part of our personality. I would just love your kind of reflections on that.
Yeah, I think my wife said something to me, it's now probably about 15 years ago maybe, and she said, "No one's looking that hard, Dan." And what she means, and I think this is true, is that people particularly, I think, in the social media era, everyone psychologically, they're so concerned with their reputation and what other people think about what they're doing and how other people will regard it and how it'll go down in history. And I remember David Owen, and he always thought this was very funny, he once said he thought that history would judge what he'd done, you know, kindly. And somebody said, "I think history will have other better things to do." I thought that was a brilliant comment, and is probably true, right? So what you live and what you do now, and the way you do it too, and how you enjoy yourself, that is it, right? That's what I think.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's important to me that, I don't know, I make the world a nicer place for everybody who has any contact with me to live in and live by my life. I'm sure some people think that the way that I think we can make the world better is horrendous, and you know, I'm making it much worse, and other people will think I'm right. But the most important thing to understand is not, you know, you're only making a tiny impact anyway. Even, you know, I've been lucky enough to, I don't know, to have a best-selling book and to work on a national newspaper, to be on television and all those kind of things. And the impact is new, you know, if I'm completely honest, the impact nugatory, and it doesn't, I think it's so important to understand that, because, you know, you've got to live and enjoy your life, because one day you won't have it anymore. So I that's the way I view it. You know, one of the things I'm so happy about with Chelsea is just what an amazing thing to do, right?
Yeah.
Forget all the kind of, you know, what it means and whether anyone else will be impressed by it and how it looks on my CV and all those kind of stuff. It's just incredible.
And that was my final question, was what's your most favourite or most memorable Chelsea moment?
I think every Chelsea fan will definitely say the 2012 Champions League final.
Yeah.
Unquestionably, but I Frank Lampard is a total hero to me. One of the great joys of the last 5 to 10 years has been getting to know Frank Lampard, somebody that I thought I'd never even meet. So I kind of think the moment should really relate to Frank. And so I've got a slightly odd memory, which was of Chelsea being behind against Stoke City when we desperately needed to win and there were 3 minutes left, and we scored twice in 3 minutes with him scoring the second goal. And that is an incredibly great memory for me. I think he's he was an amazing player, and he's actually, by the way, he's like, it says never meet your heroes. Well, I've met him and he's great.
That is one where it is totally worth meeting them. Yeah, no, well, he did a pretty good job at Derby County as well, so I'm a big fan as well. Shame you pinched him from us, but I kind of understand that move. Danny, thanks so much for coming on Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. It's really been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to have you on. I think we could have done an episode into almost any one of your sort of 5 or 6 jobs, but no, it's been great to discuss them all.
Thanks. It's really, really good to go on this podcast because actually you've asked me questions and had discussions I've never had with anyone else or on any other media. So I completely understand why this podcast has become so successful.